Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's Memorial Day weekend show, we've got a lot of films to talk about. We've got Top Gun Maverick, the Bob's Burgers movie, A Banquet, Stranger Things Season 4 Volume 1, and Obi-Wan Kenobi. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at the original Salem's Lot from 1979. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news is a piece of sad news, and this goes out for Ray Liotta. He's the actor who most people will recognize from movies like Goodfellas, and even just recently, he was in No Sudden Move on HBO Max. He was in The Many Saints of Newark, and he was actually filming a movie in the Dominican Republic, and he passed away in his sleep this week. He was only 67, so, I mean, 67 isn't, like, young, but it's young to suddenly die without any sort of, you know, warning. You know, usually when somebody's that age, there's news that they've been sick or something. But yeah, it was a surprise to everybody. He was in the middle of shooting a movie. So I'm sure we're going to get some more information from that in the next coming days. He may have had a medical issue that he just never, no one ever knew about. I mean, look at like Chadwick Boseman, who had cancer and nobody knew until he suddenly just poof, just died. But yeah, Ray Liotta, talk about a distinguished career. I mean, I think his defining role was Goodfellas. I think that's really what put him on the map. But he was also in movies like Field of Dreams. He played Shoeless Joe. And, he played a lot of these characters over the years. And usually he turned into acerbic, mean-spirited characters. He always played the heavy and the tough guy and the mobster, the gangster, very, very well. Apparently he was, you know, like everybody would say about anyone who plays sort of that hard-nosed character, that he was a big teddy bear inside in normal life. But pretty much if you had a mean person, like you had either a gangster or you had like a lawyer or you had a boss that nobody liked, he was perfect for those kind of roles. And that was a shock to me. I was not expecting that. And it was very sad to hear. So yes, you will be missed. Ray Liotta passed away at age 67. The next piece of news is I just kind of want to talk a little bit about managing your expectations for the movies this weekend. Everything we've seen promoted about Top Gun is it's the greatest movie ever. It is the movie of the summer is what I'm hearing. And it's what movies are all about, and it's going to save cinemas. And I'm urging people to tap the brakes on this a little bit, because this is the way movies are promoted. And Top Gun has been waiting so long to get released. I mean, it was delayed heavily through the pandemic, and that was not something they could have pivoted to Paramount Plus, so to speak. So while it's going to do well, I would not expect it to do like the Batman level well or Spider-Man No Way Home level well, although the early marketing seems to say that. But I think what we're going to be seeing in the box office when everything shakes out by the end of the weekend is this is the new normal in terms of box office. We have a big release, it's going to make a lot of money, and there's going to be a cool down period between movies. But it's going to be really interesting to see what happens over this summer, because we're starting to hit the stride of summer where you're getting a new movie released every week or two in terms of a big movie. I mean, you've got Thor: Love and Thunder coming up. You've got Jurassic World Dominion coming up. You've got a lot of big movies that are expecting big numbers. And the movies earlier this year, like Spider-Man and the Batman and Doctor Strange, those huge tentpole movies, and even something like Uncharted, those things had a couple weeks to just sort of dominate the box office. But we're going to see what happens, because the number of movies that are doing big box office is way down, even though theaters are completely open now. Now, and if you count Top Gun, which will be over $100 million, and The Lost City, which is probably going to crack it this weekend, only six movies have cracked $100 million in the first 5 months of the year. And I think we're starting to see what theatrical distribution is going to be able to handle, because we're not talking about pandemic anymore. And I've been saying this for weeks. We're talking about people's viewing habits have changed. People are now used to watching stuff at home and they don't go to the movies unless it's like a real reason to go, like the big, huge movie. Like Top Gun's going to draw people to the theater. I don't know about other movies out there. I mean, you have the aberrations like, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is a huge hit for such a small movie. But that's not going to be the normal. And then we even look at the box office from this last week, and Doctor Strange won again with $32 million, which is right before Memorial Day weekend. That's kind of a low number to win. Downton Abbey only made $16 million, which is about half of the opening it did for its predecessor, which shows that as beautiful as that movie is on the big screen, people are not flocking to see it on the big screen as they were before, because they also know it's got this two-month or less theatrical window, and then it's going to show up on streaming. And for the old people who want to just sit at home and possibly will fall asleep during the movie, they're going to want to have a chance to pause it and come back and watch it the next day. Now, what's interesting is Men got $3.2 million, which actually is pretty good considering how low of a cinema score it had and how polarizing the film is. But again, this makes sense. People aren't flocking to see Men. I think Men is going to see a lot more life on streaming and VOD. We just may never hear about it because it's not going to be making hundreds of millions of dollars that way. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer is for Thor: Love and Thunder, which comes into theaters on July 8th.
The old ex-girlfriend.
What's it been like? 3-4 years?
8 years, 7 months, and 6 days, give or take.
My sensing feelings.
The only ones who gods care about is themselves.
So this is my vow.
All gods will die.
I have not been shy about my love of the Marvel movies, and I am very much a fan of Taika Waititi and some of the things he's done so far with the Marvel Universe. I loved Thor Ragnarok, I think, really took things to a whole new level, even within the Marvel Universe, mixing, you know, real serious story elements with some very whimsical and fun stuff. And it looks like you're going to be getting that as well with Thor: Love and Thunder. And I love the fact that they're not just doing crossover characters as a aberration. The crossover character element in these movies is becoming common, which is cool. I like that because that feels like the comic books. I like the fact that they're taking the point of saying we're going to replace Thor with another Thor, and it's going to be Natalie Portman. And at least in the trailer for this, she looks like she worked out, because normally she looks like she's about, you know, 89 pounds and you could knock her over with a stiff breeze. But, you know, she looks like she got, you know, put on a little bit of muscle here. So, yeah, Thor: Love and Thunder, I'm very much looking forward to. I very much can't wait to see this one. The next one I want to talk about is Beast, which enters theaters on August 19th.
I've never seen anything like this. Multiple attacks without eating its prey. Lions don't do that. At least no lion I've ever seen. Shh. Go back to the calls.
Dad, please!
I've got to get my girls out of here.
I need you to trust me right now.
It's a little hard to figure out what's going on by that trailer. It basically stars Idris Elba as a guy who travels with his daughters to Africa, and they get trapped on the road with a rampaging lion. So it's one of those real-life monster movies. You know, it's not a shark, it's not a crocodile, it's a lion. And it's been a while since we've had a really good lion movie out. I mean, there was The Ghost in the Darkness, but God, that thing was 25, maybe more years old. I mean, that's the one with Michael Douglas. But yeah, we haven't had a really good, solid killer lion movie in a while. I'm looking forward to seeing this because they have some really good CGI and you can actually make it look real. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing Idris Elba go head-to-head with King of the Jungle. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Obi-Wan Kenobi and a banquet. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the new reviews. First content is going to be actually something on television. It's on streaming Disney Plus. It is the new Star Wars series, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Ewan McGregor stars as the exiled Jedi, keeping watch over Luke Skywalker on Tatooine, finding himself on another important mission.
Jedi cannot help what they are. Their compassion leaves a trail. The Jedi Code is like an itch. He cannot help it. Where is he?
Before I even talk about the content of the TV series, I find it interesting Disney did not provide any early screenings for this for press, which is odd. Usually they send out screeners to a lot of the approved press. They've done that for, you know, all the Marvel series. They did that for the other Star Wars series. They did that for Rescue Rangers. Yet they didn't do it for Obi-Wan Kenobi. And here's why I think. The Star Wars fans are very fickle, and the people who write reviews tend to be very fickle as well. Because what it is everybody grew up with Star Wars, and as an adult, everybody wants something different. And so people get really grumpy and crotchety and go, well, this isn't giving me the same feeling I had when I was seven. Well, of course it doesn't. You're not seven anymore. And this is one of the things I saw people complaining about after the huge critical hit that Boba Fett took, the Book of Boba Fett. I understand why Disney pulled this way, because people are like, oh, it was just, you gotta get off of Tatooine. We need to do different things. And all this was just nostalgia and stupidity, and oh, I didn't like this, and it was just bringing all the stuff back from the old movies, and I wanted something bigger. It's just Pulp Fiction. That's what Star Wars is. It's always been Pulp Fiction. It was based on serials. It was based on popular culture, and even if you look at the original Star Wars movies, they're not well-written stories in terms of classical stories. They fit archetypes. They're basically Westerns put onto space. They're not deep stories. People, I think, have grown up with them, and it's become a part of them, and it's hardwired into their DNA like I am. And so when it's different than what it felt like when you were seven, that's okay. And I can watch something and say, oh, this is kind of fun. We're sort of filling in these gaps of Obi-Wan Kenobi's life, what he did for those 20 years or so when Luke Skywalker was growing up on Tatooine. Now, when it comes to this show, there's only two episodes that are available right now, and they're going to be dropping a new one every week. It's going to go through the end of June. I think there's six episodes, so you get two of them this week, and then one per week. And what's interesting is it's a slow start. You don't get the hitting the ground running effect that you have with certain other things. They're taking their time. They're not just throwing everything out in that first couple minutes. You know, the first episode, you don't even know what it's about. And in that first episode, you're sort of getting your footing and figuring out what Obi-Wan Kenobi's doing on Tatooine and his relationship with Owen Lars. And I appreciate that. Now, while it's not loaded with action from the beginning, that's okay. It's setting things up. And it's okay to take a breather and take some time to develop. And in fact, in some ways, I think that this episodic television series format might be a better way to go for some of the Star Wars stuff, because I thought that that worked for Boba Fett, even though I was in the minority for that. I thought that works for The Mandalorian, and they've got a whole list of other series that are coming. They've got Andor, and they've got Ahsoka, which is based on the character that we also see show up in The Mandalorian, but also is from The Clone Wars. They're taking their time to play around with it, and they're doing what the extended universe did with Star Wars in the books and the comics and the games and the role-playing games and all that other stuff that none of y'all people did or read or played, but which kept Star Wars alive for 40 years. So it still needs to get its footing. It's still sort of figuring out where the characters are and what they're doing with each other. But I have faith. I enjoyed the first two episodes. Like I said, they weren't loaded with action, But that's okay. You don't need it to be loaded with action, because wasn't that what everybody complained about with the Book of Boba Fett? So watch these for what they are. They are long-form stories that delve deeper and give you a little bit more background to the characters and have some fun. Plus, the other thing, I gotta say, as a sci-fi fan, I find it incredible that for like $10 a month or $15 a month, you can get two streaming services and get the entirety of Star Wars and the entirety of Star Trek. And both of those properties are developing new content and airing it every week. We got Strange New Worlds on Paramount Plus. That's your, get your Star Trek fix. Now we've got Obi-Wan Kenobi on Disney Plus. That gets your Star Wars fix. And it's just going to keep going because they got more and more stuff coming down the pike. I think this is the second golden age of science fiction, and it's taking place on streaming. So I'm going to have to say Obi-Wan Kenobi, at least the first two episodes of season one, kind of rock.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about A Banquet. This was originally released in theaters. It's an IFC midnight movie, and it is now coming exclusively to Shudder this weekend. A widowed mother of two teenage girls starts to reach a crisis point when her older daughter stops eating and believes she is destined for something metaphysical.
You're unwell. We'll figure this out, okay? I can feel something inside of me. I've been chosen.
You're a very good mother.
Do not infect this family with your ideas.
This is getting seriously out of control.
Are you suggesting Betsy's been possessed by a demon?
Quite the opposite. I believe Betsy's possessed this family.
Not a whole lot happens in this movie. And there's a lot of horror movies that are made that have a very limited cast and limited locations. That's the essence of horror. We've been seeing that for years, decades even. And this one has that, where it's this mother and these two daughters, and a good chunk of the movie is just them at home and her interacting with some of her friends, either in limited relations in school or at parties, or she goes to the doctor's office. But it's clear they don't have a cast of thousands and they don't have all these epic locations. That allows you to shoot something on a limited budget, and horror films lend themselves to that. That's a haunted house story, you know, it all takes place in the house. This is an haunted house, but the whole point is you have this setup. And while it's an interesting idea and it has all this sort of subtext about being a teenage girl and the forces of the world against you and expectations that you're supposed to have and expectations of your parents and trying to live up to certain things and image ideas and how you interact with other people, the struggle I had with this is just not a whole lot happens. You just kind of want to, like, okay, it's only an hour and a half, but you're like, wow, this really probably was only about 40 minutes of story. And that happens also a lot in horror fiction. So even it's an interesting enough film, and I didn't dislike it. It just left me a little bit cold, and it was a little slow. It has something to say. It's just, it seems it's afraid to say it. And at a certain point, you've got to get your courage up to make your statement in horror fiction, and this one doesn't quite do it. But still, I'm going to give A Banquet a kind of rocks because it does have an interesting thing going on in it.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Top Gun Maverick and the Bob's Burgers movie. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the big one in the theater, the one that everybody's talking about, and that is Top Gun Maverick. Tom Cruise returns in this story about a Maverick Navy pilot who is brought back to an elite training program in order to teach a new generation how to make a seemingly impossible combat run.
We're going into combat on a level no living pilot's ever seen.
Not even him.
You think up there you're dead. Believe me.
My dad believed in you. I'm not gonna make the same mistake.
Someone's not coming back from this.
Those are your pilots. Anything happens to them.
You're
you'll never forgive yourself.
Before I even start with the review, I have a confession to make. I am not a big fan of the original Top Gun. I know, I grew up in the 80s. I was 15 when this movie came out. I should have been right there in the sweet spot. Everyone I knew loved the movie. Everybody I knew went to go see the movie. I didn't even see the movie when it was in theaters. I just didn't have any interest in it. I don't know why. I don't even remember where my mindset was in 1986 to make me not want to go out of my way to go see Top Gun. And, you know, once you missed it after a couple weeks, everybody had already seen it. And I understand the pop culture impact it had, and it really helped make Tom Cruise a star, and it had this just awesome soundtrack. I love the soundtrack. I actually had the soundtrack, I think, as a kid on cassette tape. But I never watched the movie, and I finally saw the movie later on VHS. It may have been DVD by the time I actually watched the whole movie. So I'd seen bits and pieces of the movie, but I never sat straight through it for many years. So you have to understand that going in. I'm not one of these people who was dying for this new Top Gun movie to come out. There's people out there that I've heard and talked to who are just dying for this movie. And that's great. I'm all for that. It is a bit frustrating when people that are critics, some friends of mine, and I'll see them, and when like anytime a Star Wars things comes out, they're like, you know, like Obi-Wan Kenobi, they're like, ah, it's just nostalgia. It's crap. They're just playing on nostalgia. Ugh. Oh, but I love Top Gun. It was the greatest movie ever. It's what movies are made of. Look, I'm going to admit, first of all, Top Gun Maverick is 100% nostalgia. Almost to an annoying level. The opening credit sequence, I couldn't tell whether that was newly shot footage. Because it looks exactly like the footage from the original movie. I mean, they could have just replayed all that, or they could have taken alternate takes from that footage. I don't know enough about Navy air technology to be able to identify whether it was a modern plane or whether it was shot in 1986. And there's elements to this movie that are just retreaded, scooped right out like a dish of ice cream out from the first movie. You got Tom Cruise riding his motorcycle down the road by the ocean. You've got shenanigans going on in the bar. You've got all these things that are just a complete retread of the original movie. But I'll come out there and say, that's okay. Now, for me, that didn't really have much of an effect because I'm not that crazy fan of the first movie. But if that's what you want to see, if you want to be treated to the aesthetic and the feel and the look and the characterization that they had in the first movie, you're absolutely getting this. Everything's there. The cinematography, the action, the music, the sound, the heavy machismo, which it just hoses the entire audience with machismo. And, you know, the at times somewhat almost uncomfortable jingoism that goes on in the movie, which is also from the first one. But a lot of the problems from the first movie are 100% apparent in this movie, too, where every character is just thrown in there with a call sign and they don't actually characterize anybody. They're just like, this guy's Maverick. I kept expecting Tom Cruise, whenever something goes wrong, him to just say to a superior officer, hey, I'm just a Maverick, don't you know? That's why they call me Maverick. And he's like, yeah, that's why we've got Miles Teller. He's playing Rooster. He's a cocky guy who struts around and peacocks all over the place. And then there's another guy who's Hangman, and they literally have to explain, well, he's Hangman because he'll hang you out to dry as your wingman. You don't want him as your wingman. And nobody has any sort of real characterization. They're just sort of these cookie-cutter things thrown in there. But that's kind of what Top Gun's about. There's not a whole lot of characterization that goes on in the first movie. Let's face it. So, I mean, like I said, all the elements from the original movie are there. And they're there in spades, and they are done extremely well in this movie, and in some ways better than the original film. But it is still all of those elements, whether they're good, like a great soundtrack, or the cinematography, or whether they're bad with underdeveloped characters, and they have some people are returned, you know, see some familiar faces. Some of them you don't. They're like, well, they got rid of that character. But I have to say, you know, so if you love the Top Gun movie and you wanted to see more of the same, you absolutely get it. And the final 30 minutes of the movie is what totally sells it. It's actually fantastic action. It's real people in real cockpits and real planes going through real air over real land and sea. And that's impressive to see. And it's edited together very well. I mean, it's put together to this very impressive action, you know, last half hour, you know, almost like a Star Wars movie. But there's something special about this movie. I'll absolutely say the fact that Tom Cruise insisted on doing real world type stunts. And granted, he's not really flying a jet. I think they have somebody else flying it, but he's in the cockpit and you see him. They're really in the air. And what's funny is nowadays, anytime they do this kind of combat flight type stuff in a movie, it's all blue screened in. He insisted on having it look real and it looks great. Now you go back to 1986, they had no other choice but to shoot it that way because they didn't have CGI blue screen. They were just starting to get that right around that time. So they didn't have the technology to do it now. So it's very impressive that they stuck to their guns, no pun intended, and made a movie with real action sequences. And that's really the selling point. I mean, all the goofy character stuff aside, that last half hour is a banging half hour, and it really, really works. And it'll, you know, even if somebody who's sort of like, yeah, the movie's okay, I really did enjoy the ending. So it's a good, fun, solid movie. It's worth seeing. So I'm going to have to say Top Gun Maverick kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the Bob's Burgers movie. The Belcher family gets caught up in a years-old murder investigation when a sinkhole opens in front of their burger joint.
You have 7 days to make your payment.
Seven?
It's gonna be okay, Bob. Happy. Hopeful. Kissy lips.
Please.
Oh!
Oh, my God.
Louise, don't go down there. It's dangerous.
Ah! Is this a police? I'd like to report a thing happened.
What do we do? Ideas. Go.
Ooh, what's this thing?
No. Ah!
Can you believe it?
Ta-da!
I feel bad for Bob's Burgers because they are getting short shrift this whole weekend. Everybody's talking about Top Gun. Nobody's talking about the Belcher family. And I love Bob's Burgers. I remember watching, I remember I got the DVD was sent to me by Fox way back when the show started. That's back when they actually sent DVDs to reviewers on a regular basis. And that's when I first saw it. And I fell in love with that series from the beginning. I thought it was fantastic. It's a fun show and I love the show. And it's sort of like what they did with the Simpsons movie, where the Simpsons movie was made while the show was running. And that's a danger because you want to still get people to come back every week and watch it for free, but you got to give them something bigger for the big screen. And they do tell a big screen movie. I mean, it's still an animated film, but there's a little more action. There's a little more things that our people are doing. The characters have a bigger story. There's a little more elaborate setup and locations than just in the burger joint. And they give everybody something to do. And that's impressive because that's kind of hard to do with, you know, when you have that much of an established character, because there's always an A story and the B story of the parents and the kids. And the kids have their own thing to do. Now, it's not like an episode devoted entirely to Gene or to Louise. They do kind of have them all three work together, and that does work. And then, of course, Bob and Linda are also doing their things. And they have the music in there, you know, the songs, because you can't have a Bob's Burgers movie without Linda breaking into song now and then. But it's a fun movie. It's completely satisfying. And I really didn't enjoy it. I think it's just going to be under the afterburners of Top Gun Maverick, which is a shame. I'm afraid that it's not going to do as well because I think they're going for Top Gun to be sort of that four quadrant opening. And this one isn't really a kids movie either. So this might have been one that would have been better to release next weekend. Who knows? This may have been a flub on Disney or Fox. But still, I like Bob's Burgers movie actually better. So I'm going to have to say the Bob's Burgers movie totally rocked.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Stranger Things, Season 4, Volume 1, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Salem's Lot. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the reviews with Stranger Things, Season 4, Volume 1. While separated by hundreds of miles, the kids from Hawken face a new threat, a serial killer from the Upside Down targeting the teenagers of the town.
I relocated you guys far from Hawkins. Because I thought you'd be safe. Is coming. I'm afraid your friends at Hawkins are very much in the eye of the storm. Without you, we can't win this war.
I don't know if I have the same opinion of Stranger Things that a lot of other people do. I loved the first season. I thought the first season was really good, but it was heavy and a little sticky, and it took some time to really get moving and get dust out of its gears and to get to know the characters. The second season I thought was an improvement, but I don't think it hit its stride until the third season. My favorite season of Stranger Things is the season 3, the one that takes place in the mall over the summer. And it's not just a nostalgia factor, although I remember what it was like to go to the mall in 1985 during that summer and watch some of the movies that were playing in that movie theater. You know, so it did capture the essence of the 80s, but that's not just it. I thought the characters worked because you don't just have the boys and then 11. You also have the older kids. You've got Natalie and Jonathan and Steve and everybody like that. And of course, now they've added, Maya Hawke as Robin in one of these characters. And you've now got, of course, Max with the kids and everything. So they've expanded the cast. And one of the things they did in order to balance the stories is they split everybody up in season 2 and 3. But season 3, it really, really worked because they did some sort of, unexpected casting choices, like putting together Dustin and Steve and throwing Robin in there was really good. And they do the same thing here because, as things starts out, quite literally, Will and his mother have moved with Elle to California and not Hawkins, Indiana. So they're already scattered to the four winds. And then you've also got the story of Hopper, whatever happened to Hopper. And that sort of follows these three different storylines that they're going through. And it does splinter even a little bit more. Here's the thing with this season. Every episode is long. There is not a single episode that's less than an hour. And most of them are an hour and 15 minutes or more. And normally that worries me. I remember when Sons of Anarchy was on, I ended up stop watching the show because I was so bored because episodes just were needlessly long. They'd be like an hour and a half, and they'd all end with this 10-minute musical montage. And I'm like, well, that now it's just become stupidly formulaic, like a Grey's Anatomy episode. But one of the things they do with Stranger Things season 4 is while they're longer stories, they're setting things up. It's not just a return of the Demogorgon or a different version of that. There's something else in the Upside Down that's causing a problem, and they have to kind of start from scratch. It's just they don't have to go through the discovery and convince themselves that the fantastic is real. And I appreciate the fact that they don't always go back to, well, this can't happen again. They're just like, well, here we go again. More crazy stuff from the Upside Down. It's up to us to take care of it. It doesn't pull its punches, but it also enriches the background and the history. And there's 7 episodes that are available right now. You're going to have to wait till, I think it's July 11th to get the rest of it. But I got to say, the first 7 episodes of Stranger Things, they move fast. They're dense. They pack a lot of stuff in there. And it has the dread and the danger that you had in the first couple seasons. But it also has the whimsy and the fun and the likable characters. Like what they do with Joyce, which I'm not going to go into, but in the first season of Stranger Things, Joyce is insufferable because she's a grieving mother who can't find her son. Her son has disappeared. So I don't blame her and I don't blame necessarily the writing, but once she got over getting Will back, there's nothing you can really throw at Joyce that she's not, whatever, I've seen this kind of crap before. And there's a fun nature to that. And they pair her up with Murray. He's still in there from season 3. So they have these return of these characters and it does work. And there's also a purpose that everybody has the same end goal, but not the same agenda. And that's very real in life. So I really enjoyed Stranger Things Season 4, Volume 1. I still have yet to see it end because they still got 2 more episodes, which is about 4 hours worth of programming, later this summer. But it's a great way to kick off this new season. So I'm going to say Stranger Things Season 4, Volume 1, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Salem's Lot from 1979, and there's a reason why I picked this up, because they're remaking Salem's Lot that James Wan's involved in, and that should be coming out in September. And that's one of my favorite Stephen King books. I haven't reread it. I read it once when I was a kid and I loved it. I've never gone and revisited. I don't know if it would still stay up as one of my favorite books, but I always loved it. It's an allegory to Dracula, and it also is a story about the destruction and degradation of the small town life in America in the later half of the 20th century. The book came out in 1974, and in 1979, I think it was CBS, did a mini series of it, a two-night event, and you can now find it on Tubi, which is a great resource if you're looking for some obscure stuff, especially stuff that's a TV nature, things like TV shows or, you know, old miniseries or something. But anyway, Salem's Lot, based on the novel by Stephen King. This miniseries follows a writer who returns to his hometown only to find it the target of an ancient vampire.
Ben Mears has been away too long. And now at last, he's come home. Home to Salem's Lot, a town too good to be true.
What was that? Wait, Danny, wait!
Something is happening.
Unless the kid disappears, then this.
Don't you understand what's happening?
You?
They're breeding on one another. The vampires are creating vampires.
I read the book sometime in the mid-80s, and so it was about 10 years old at the time, and then I got a VHS and I watched this miniseries. And you know what? I was unimpressed back in the 80s. I didn't think it was as good as it could have been. Part of it is because, you know, it was a miniseries. And the reality is it was dealing with more adult themes, not adult themes as in titillating adult themes, but adult themes that you don't really quite understand until you're in your 30s. And that's why I feel I need to go back and revisit reading the book. Now, I, in retrospect, really appreciate what they did with this one. It was directed by Tobe Hooper, and I also have a better sense now of the limitations budgetarily and production-wise that you would have on a miniseries that was made for TV back in the late 70s. I mean, you couldn't do too much gore, you couldn't do too much blood, you couldn't do too much violence or swearing or anything like that. You couldn't really make it R-rated. So there was limitations to it. And you compare it to something like the It miniseries that came out, what, like 11 years later. And I actually have to say, this Salem's Lot, I think it handles it much better. It's got some genuinely creepy stuff. In rewatching this, like when the vampires visit people at their window, they do this sort of reverse photography. I mean, it's really well done. And also understanding Stephen King's writing more now and his perspective as writing it as an adult, and watching it as an adult, it makes more sense when he's dealing with the inner connectivity of the characters, whereas they were just sort of archetypes to me as a kid watching it. And there's some great performances in there. You know, you've got like James Mason as one of the bad guys. He's the guy who basically, he's the Renfield. He's the guy who facilitates the vampire coming to town. And he's fantastic. I mean, he's in the waning days of his career. And, you know, he's sort of slumming it doing a TV movie, but, you know, he still comes in and does his James Mason thing. And as much as when I read the book, how much it reminded me of the original story of Dracula, going back and watching this reminds me of how much inspiration Fright Night, which came out only about 6 years later, how much inspiration Fright Night drew from this movie itself and probably from the book as well. So I gotta say, it's a little bit long because it runs 3 hours because it was a two-night miniseries with commercials. But it's worth checking out. Find it on Tubi. You gotta sit through ads. But then again, when you watched it originally in 1979, you had to sit through ads. It holds up much better than I thought it would. And I'm glad I went back and revisited it. It's worth the time. So I'm gonna have to say Salem's Lot from 1979 kinda rocks.
It kinda rocks.
When it comes to home cinema, new on disc, you've got The Batman, as well as X, finally hit disc, and Trekkies, a new release of Trekkies, the Star Trek fan documentary. And then, of course, on AMC, you've got all of Better Call Saul Season 6, Volume 1, plus a nice little added animated series called Slippin' Jimmy that's available with these Better Call Saul stuff. Anyways, that's it for the show. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Phantom of the Open and Crimes of the Future. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.